You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. In the second half of tonight's show, we're going to listen to a speech by Pacifica reporter and former Iraq correspondent Jeremy Scahill, whose reports from the front lines in Iraq, Yugoslavia, and Nigeria have earned him some of the highest awards in journalism. He spoke several years ago to students at St. Peter's College in Jersey City, New Jersey, about his reporting experiences and what he perceived as the dangers of American foreign policy.
I was one of the student leaders of a campaign to fight for the rights of people who were homeless living on the campus of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I was listening day after day to so-called progressive professors preaching a social justice gospel. But when it came time to speak up for those who were less fortunate on our campus, who didn't have mom and dad's credit card to whip them through college, the professors weren't there to stand for them. They were there to stand for their tenure, and I couldn't reconcile going back into classrooms to listen to professors who preached one message and practiced a very silent other one. With the ongoing United States-led NATO bombing of Yugoslavia and the horrific ethnic cleansing going on in Kosovo, there's a lot of discussion about this being one of the greatest human tragedies, certainly of my lifetime. But I would say that the greatest tragedy of all of our lifetimes in this room today is American foreign policy. That is the greatest human tragedy of our lifetime. All of us in this room today have a choice, as we have throughout history had this choice, to stand on the trigger side of the gun, pointed at so many others around the world, and participate in the annihilation of other cultures, other peoples, democratic principles, the gun wielded by the American government and multinational corporations, many of which are based in this country. We have a choice to stand on that side of the gun, the trigger side, or to stand with those who are forced to live on the other side. And I think the question that all of us need to answer in this room is, which side are we on? I wanted to talk a little bit about Iraq and Nigeria, and of course the connection to both of those would be oil. Iraq historically being one of the largest producers of oil in the world, and Nigeria being the largest country in Africa, the largest oil producer in Africa, and the sixth largest oil producer in the world. Both of those countries have extraordinarily repressive military dictatorships, and both are victims of that great human tragedy I spoke of, American foreign policy. But I think to begin with Iraq and to understand the current situation with an unprecedented regime of economic sanctions that are solely responsible for an overwhelming majority of the suffering in Iraq, it's important to go back to the so-called Gulf War. I don't mean to be rhetorical, but I don't call it a war, I call it a massacre, and I don't think that that's an engagement in rhetoric, because when you have such an unbalanced show of force against a country with so many of the casualties, and they shouldn't even be called casualties, what they are is killings and deaths, torture and injury, when you have such an imbalance of victims on one side, and there were Americans who died, but the numbers were overwhelmingly on the Iraqi side. It's important to go back to that massacre, actually toward the end of it. In February of 1991, the United States had debated moving from the south of Iraq north to go and take Baghdad with ground troops, but a decision was made not to do that. But the United States did give the Iraqi government and military, which had shown nominal signs of independence, a parting gesture that resulted in many hundreds, perhaps thousands of deaths. And some people may be familiar with the story, but it's worth talking about. It's the story of what we know as the Highway of Death. As the massacre was coming to an end, Iraqi soldiers and civilians were fleeing Kuwait. And as they were fleeing Kuwait on the Basra Highway, the United States came in and dropped bombs in front of them and drop bombs behind them, and they were trapped. And many veterans, U.S. veterans, in congressional testimony and interviews following the Highway of Death, described what happened after that as a turkey shoot. As the civilians and soldiers began fleeing Kuwait in caravans of trucks, some of them on foot, the United States brought in ground troops, and they opened fire on the fleeing civilians and soldiers. U.S. planes bombed with depleted uranium-tipped bombs, depleted uranium being nuclear waste, the most potent coating that you can put on a bullet known to modern warfare. And they did this turkey shoot. Hundreds, perhaps thousands of people were killed. And one veteran of that turkey shoot, his job was to drive a Bradley armored vehicle, like a tank with a big shovel on the front of it. And he admitted to actually burying soldiers alive, burying people alive that were on the highway of death. And he wrote a letter back to his aunt that was published in the New York Times in 1995. And in that letter he said, "Killing Iraqis was real hard at first, but after the first time it got easy." That veteran is on death row today in the United States. His appeal to the Supreme Court was just denied, and his name is Timothy McVeigh. The question that needs to be posed in the context of Yugoslavia today, in the context of Nigeria, and in the context certainly and undoubtedly without question about Iraq, and this question should be posed to President Clinton, to Secretary of War William Cohen, because it's not a Department of Defense, it's a Department of War, to General Hugh Shelton, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and to all of the others who support American foreign policy. Does it get easier after the first time to kill all these people around the world? That is the central question for the policymakers in Washington today and for those who carry it out. The United States speaks a strong rhetoric about sovereignty, as was the case regarding the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. But let's talk about the U.S. record on sovereignty. Did the United States have concerns for sovereignty when they aided the cabal that overthrew the democratically elected government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide in Haiti? When they overthrew the government of Jacobo Arbenz in 1954, the Dulles cabal and others from the intelligentsia in the United States, one of the first overt acts of the Central Intelligence Agency? Did the United States have concern about sovereignty when it invaded Panama? When it backed repressive death squads in Nicaragua and El Salvador? When it backed the Indonesian military and its ongoing massacre of the people of East Timor? Where were the concerns about national sovereignty then? And those are the questions we need to ask when we look at countries that we're told are our enemies. The people of Iraq have experienced an unprecedented devastation and attack on their civilian infrastructure. Schools and hospitals have been bombed by the United States, and the reason for bombing a school is there is research going on for chemical and biological and nuclear weapons programs, so we need to bomb that school. Certain hospitals have medicines that could be considered dual use. They could be used for medical purposes or they could be used for purposes of war. So, well, we need to bomb that as well. The United States destroys any chance for a democratic uprising in countries like Iraq, and now in countries like Yugoslavia. There was no consultation with the democratic opposition to Slobodan Milosevic. There was an ultimatum, 30,000 troops or bombing. No sovereign country in the world would accept 30,000 NATO troops. And the government of Slobodan Milosevic is a repressive regime committing unconscionable crimes against humanity. And that should be said, but so too it should be said that what the United States government is doing right now is also unconscionable. I agree that Slobodan Milosevic should be indicted as a war criminal, but so too should President Clinton. In Iraq in 1990, the currency was one of the most valuable in the world. I'm holding a fat roll of Iraqi dinars right now. This currency was extraordinarily valuable. Three American dollars equaled one Iraqi dinar in 1990. Today, it is 1,760 Iraqi dinars to the dollar. I got 66,000 American dollars in my hand right now in 1990. Today, almost nothing, $15. Wages have remained virtually static. Imagine that. Wages have remained virtually static. With the currency going from one of the most valuable in the world to almost worth less than dirt. I had seen videos, pictures, read testimony about the suffering of the Iraqi people under what we call economic sanctions. It's a very copacetic term. Sounds very clean. It sounds like an alternative to war. But in the modern era, we need to redefine for the policymakers in Washington, what is a war? Because as the foreign minister of Cuba, Roberto Rabina, says, we don't call a war anymore. And what's happening right now to the people of Iraq is in fact a war, whether or not there are bombs falling, because the reality is that before one bomb fell on Iraq in so-called Operation Desert Fox in December of 98, Iraq was a country of unimaginable human suffering. Estimates range between hundreds of thousands all the way up into 1.5 million civilians killed by the U.S.-imposed sanctions on that country. They call them United Nations, but it's really the U.S. agenda manifesting itself under the guise of international cooperation. I saw a child born in the south of the country in Basra, which I spoke about before, the country that was on the receiving end of tons and tons of bombs dropped by the United States, coated with depleted uranium, with nuclear waste. And those bombs were coated with that because they're more potent. And they also coated the bullets that American and British soldiers fired off with depleted uranium because they can pierce through armor. In some cases, they can pierce through tanks. They use those at a high cost that continues to happen in Iraq and also in this country. There was a study done last year that took together people from Iraq and Kuwait and Britain and the United States, and most of them from Britain and the United States were soldiers. And what that found was that many of the soldiers in the United States and Britain are experiencing some of the same health problems as people in Iraq. Many attribute that to the use of this nuclear waste coating on these bullets. But today in the newspaper, we read, an independent report released by the Pentagon indicates that exposure to radioactive material used in the Gulf War is unlikely to have caused the health complaints from veterans whose illnesses remain unexplained 8 years after the war. Then you explain why veterans are puking up orange vomit. You explain why children in Iraq, and I saw a 7-day-old kid who was born when I was there and is dead now, born with no mouth, not just a cleft palate, a hole the size of the top of a Pepsi can, and that child shrieked and shrieked and shrieked. And the Iraqi doctor looked at our delegation and he said, plastic surgery is not an option for this child. We're reusing our syringes 5 or 6 times. You go into an Iraqi hospital, you are walking into a death row for infants. Imagine that. There is human waste on the floors of Iraqi hospitals. Children sleep on beds covered with flies. There are kids who are so malnourished that their skin has begun to eat itself. It's brown. It looks like the children are dirty, but they're not. Their skin is eating away at their body for lack of nutrition. You have mothers who have abortions against their choice because they can't sustain their own life, much less the life of another. And with all the rhetoric coming from the Catholic community against abortion, where is the rhetoric that says involuntary abortion is wrong when we impose it on the women of Iraq? I met a woman who found out when she was 8 months pregnant that her child was being born with no brain. No brain. The human catastrophe, there's not a strong enough term to describe what has happened in Iraq. Words fail us. And they talk about the oil for food program. The Iraqis call it the oil for nothing program. It should be called the oil for Kuwaiti reparations program or the oil for UNSCOM program, because less than half of it actually goes to buy food and medicine. And when that half is used, the United States imposes the severest of restrictions on what the Iraqi government can buy. They can't buy pencils because lead could be used to make weapons. They can't buy bleach to purify their water because bleach can be used to manufacture chemical weapons. Well, as a result, the leading cause of death among children are waterborne diseases. Children die from diarrhea. Imagine that. Children die from diarrhea. Malnutrition is rampant. You don't see a chubby person in Iraq who's not a member of the elite presidential guard or a member of Saddam Hussein's inner cabal. You don't see people with pot bellies or chubby. You see skinny, suffering people. And when the campaign started to educate people on the sanctions in Iraq, people in Iraq begged activists, please, we're a proud people. Do not take the case of the sanctions this way. Attack it from an international law perspective. Do not humiliate us. Well, 8 years later, the suffering at unimaginable levels, that is what the campaign has had to do, to expose just what the United States is doing. But many are not listening, and the movement is not strong enough, and it needs to be stronger. because this is one of the greatest crimes against humanity in history. The United States aims at the civilian infrastructure, not at military targets. Democracy wouldn't be profitable in Iraq for the United States, nor would it be in Yugoslavia. Now, some people may disagree with me on that, but give me a moment to explain what I mean. In the case of Nigeria, when you can put, as Chevron and Shell like to do, when you can put a few million dollars in a bank account of a corrupt general and have your way with the indigenous people, that's easier than dealing with a parliament or a Congress or a group of legislators that may have the audacity to think independently of Western powers. When you have to deal with a democratically elected government, it's not as easy to impose your neo-colonial agenda on people in Africa and the Middle East. It's easy to deal with dictators, and that's what the United States wants. In fact, the Central Intelligence Agency doesn't want a democracy in Iraq. They want a change in generals. Saddam Hussein was profitable to American foreign policy interests during the Iran-Iraq war. As Henry Kissinger once flippantly remarked to a group of reporters, wouldn't it be nice if they could kill each other off, Iran and Iraq? The United States backed the government of Saddam Hussein because it was considered a stable, secular regime, certainly more appropriate to American foreign policy interests than an Islamic fundamentalist government. On August 2, 1990, 4 days before the sanctions were imposed on Iraq, and it's fitting they were imposed on Hiroshima Day, 4 days before that, George Bush attempted to sell sensitive military technology to the government in Baghdad. It was stopped by the State Department. August 6th, the United States led the charge to impose the sanctions. By August 9th, George Bush called Saddam Hussein tantamount to Hitler. That's a one-week period. Saddam Hussein received billions of dollars of United States aid. And here's a question that should be posed. The United States talks a lot about chemical and biological weapons. Why don't we see any databases on what Iraq has? We hear about quantities, and we hear about qualities, but we don't hear about where they got it from, because many of the components were manufactured by American corporations in Maryland and California and sold to the Iraqi government. In fact, where was the United States outcry when Saddam Hussein did, in fact, use poison gases on his own people, as is so often quoted in the press? Where was the outrage? It wasn't profitable to American foreign policy interests to be outraged, but now it is. I'll wrap up just by telling you the story of our trip into Nigeria, because it relates to Iraq, and the binding factor, of course, is oil. Nigeria got its independence in 1960, and since then it has been ruled by dictator after dictator, with an occasional occurrence of the semblance of a democratically elected government, but usually resulting in a coup. The United States has backed these regimes to the tune of more than $10 billion annually through American multinational corporations like Chevron, Texaco, Mobil. You go down the list and there's not a clean hand in the bunch. We went to Nigeria, which is one of the most repressive military dictatorships in the world. Some of you may remember the name Ken Saro-Wiwa, and it's a name all of us should know. In November of 1995, Ken Saro-Wiwa, who was the country's most famous playwright, actually was the author of the most popular soap opera in the country, was a well-known pop figure who abandoned his life of privilege in Nigeria to take up the cause of the Ogoni people, his people, a minority group within the Niger Delta. There are hundreds of groups in the Delta, and Ken Saro-Wiwa rose up to defend the Ogonis, who were living under the repression of their own military backed by the Shell Corporation. And for his exposure of this corporate alliance with the military dictatorship, he was hanged. After being convicted by a kangaroo military court, Shell had lawyers present on the side of the government at that hearing. And his final words before he was hanged were, "Lord, take my soul, but the struggle continues." And the struggle has continued in Nigeria. The Niger Delta is on fire with the flames of resistance. There is a pan-Delta movement sparked by the spirit of Ken Saro-Wiwa, who is the Nigerian martyr. They're occupying oil platforms. They're seizing boats operated by Chevron, Shell, Mobil, Texaco, Exxon, and other foreign corporations from Italy and France. And what happened on May 28, 1998, which is what our documentary Drilling and Killing was about, is not unusual in Nigeria. What was unusual is that we proved that it happened. 120 youths from an area of the Niger Delta known as Elijah Land went by speedboat and canoe and occupied one of Chevron's offshore drilling facilities. Their land had been polluted. Their pigs were floating all over their riverine community. I saw them with my own eyes. Children were being born with birth defects. Their freshwater fishing people and Chevron dug canals connecting their freshwater to the ocean, and the saltwater invaded the freshwater and wiped out that ecological system. Well, the young people of that community decided that they had had enough, and they went by speedboat and canoe and occupied this platform. No weapons, nonviolently. To make a long story short, they were in the midst of negotiations with Chevron. They were told Chevron, the corporation, would get back to them in 2 days. The next morning, between 5:30 and 6 a.m., while the youths were sleeping on the barge, helicopters descended on the platform. And in those helicopters were squads from the notorious Nigerian Navy and the Mobile Police. The Mobile Police in Nigeria are known as the Kill and Go, because they kill and they go. Wielding automatic machine guns, they opened fire on the barge. They outright killed two, critically wounded a third. And the way that they critically wounded Larry Boato was when he went to pick up the bodies of the dead, a soldier opened fire on him. They shot him from behind. He was shot in his buttocks and his back and his arm. But that wasn't enough. A soldier jumped off the helicopter and stabbed him in the stomach with a bayonet. He lived to tell his story, though, and we have it on tape. And after we talked with that village to get to this community, the only white people they'd ever met were neo-colonialists from the corporations who came to pilfer their land, steal their oil, and bring it back to this country so everyone in this room can enjoy it. We went into this community, and they welcomed us, and they spoke with us. And then we went back to Lagos to the headquarters of Chevron, and we conducted a three-hour interview with the heads of their corporation there. And in that interview, we said, who took them in on Thursday morning? The Mobile Police, the Navy, the spokesperson for Chevron. We did. Chevron did. We took them there. By how? Helicopters. Yes, we took them in. Who authorized the call for the military to come in? That's Chevron's management. This is all on tape. In addition to this, their acting head of security flew in on the lead attack helicopter, and he described the scene as well and told how they tear gassed them before they shot them. And we have that on tape as well. That has sparked a congressional investigation led by Congressman Dennis Kucinich of Ohio. He summoned Chevron executives and they confirmed our story, but they've banned us from attending their press conferences because they said we have an agenda, though they've never answered to the question of what that agenda is other than exposing their criminal activity abroad. But they're just exporting the tactics that they use all throughout Nigeria against the free press. They're exporting those tactics that say when you tell the truth, as Ken Saro-Wiwa did about a multinational oil corporation's relationship to a repressive military dictatorship, you don't have a right to print freely. And I want to end with the question that I began with, and that is, all of us have a decision when we leave this room today. Which side of the gun do we want to be on? Do we want to be on the side of the gun with Chevron's hand on the trigger, with the State Department's hand on the trigger? Or do we want to stand with the victims, stand with the people who are forced to try to stop what we should have prevented in the first place, American foreign policy?
Jeremy Scahill covered the wars in Iraq and Yugoslavia for Peace Watch, Democracy Now!, and Free Speech Radio News. He spoke several years ago to students at St. Peter's College in Jersey City, New Jersey. Thanks to Bill Knapp for production assistance with that piece. On a final note tonight, this is our last week here at Peace Watch. Our program will come to an end this Friday after a week of specials, speeches, and material from our archives. We've thoroughly enjoyed producing this show over the past year, and we thank all of our listeners and supporters for their generous feedback and support, monetary and otherwise, which kept us going for so long. Our staff is entering planning and production for a new show with a broader focus to be launched November 3rd on most Pacifica stations and affiliates. Stay tuned. soon for further information and broadcast times. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. We had production assistance from Jason Coffery, David Swanson, Matt Bradley, and Sam Husseini. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Alex Mitchell at WebActive.com for web help. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send your feedback to us at peacewatch@pacifica.org. You can also visit webactive.com to listen to archives of past Peace Watch programs. To get a copy of this show, call the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.